Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am, of course, your host, Chris Martinson. And today, we're speaking with Eric Jansen, founder and president of iTulipInc.com. If you follow it there, it's a great site. I've been reader there for quite a while. It's a data-driven economic analysis firm started as the website iTulip.com in 1998. Eric is a prolific economic financial market analyst, author of several notable books, including the most recent one, The Post-Catastrophe Economy. I've invited Eric to speak here today because he's made more right calls about the global economy than almost anyone I can think of or have been following in the past decade. Today we're going to discuss his Kapoom framework and what he sees next in his macroeconomic crystal ball. Welcome, Eric. I've been looking forward to speaking with you for some time now. It's great to finally have you as a guest.
Well, it's great to be on, Chris. I guess the last time we saw each other was in Denver a couple of years ago, so it's good to catch up.
Yeah, we were at the ASPO conference, and I know that peak oil is certainly a part of your framework, just one of many pieces. You've been sending warning signals about our macroeconomic predicament, if I could use that word, since you launched iTulip.com in 1998. So can you give our listeners here the background on the specific concerns that led you to launch that site and your framework there?
Well, Chris, at the time, I was the managing director of a seed-stage venture capital firm called Osborne Capital. We were, this is Jeff Osborne, an old friend of mine out of the technology industry, and he'd made a bunch of money when UniNet went public. He was the head of VP in sales and marketing. He started investing in startups. Mostly people that he and I had known over the years in the industry. So he brought me in to sit on the boards of companies and help with new investments and so forth. So we had what I would describe as a front row seat into the technology bubble. We could see that there was something was clearly a mess, so I started to do my research that ultimately resulted in iTulip. And what my real objective here was, we had all these investments, we'd invested in 20 companies. We had seven liquidity events, a couple of IPOs, sales to Cisco, Microsoft, Nortel, and others. So my job was to, in understanding that we were actually participating in a bubble, was to know when to get out. So my research led me to believe that it was time to get out in March of 2000, and I started writing about this on iTulip as a way to share some of the information we were getting with the public. And, to counter a lot of what was coming out of the media at the time, a lot of fallacies about the new economy and so forth. And that's really been the mission of iTulip ever since.
Well, that new economy, of course, it's always some sort of false belief or some new adoption of a rationale that enables us to go a little further. Greenspan, of course, adopted many of those rationales, including the idea that risk could be offloaded and potentially made to disappear. It was no longer a real structure of our financial system and mispriced money accordingly. So in that context, I guess you were just at a Fed meeting of some sort, you've been clearly observing the Fed for a long time. Do you have any observations you can share from that meeting and generally speaking, why you follow the Fed and what you think they're up to here?
So this is a small conference, invitation only, at the Boston Federal Reserve. It's on Atlantic Avenue in downtown the financial district of Boston. And the title of it was the Aftermath of the Great Recession. And the format was a bunch of academic papers presented mostly by academic economists, peer-reviewed, and then discussed with the group. And so the audience is various kinds of economists from investment banks and all multifamily practices and so forth, to different kinds of funds. And the media, of course, is CNBC and Wall Street Journal, New York Times, all those guys are there to cover it. And also Bernanke gave a speech, and it was actually a very important speech. It wasn't particularly well covered, but I'll be happy to talk about that in a minute. But what was interesting about it, from my perspective, having covered, this cycle of asset bubbles and reflations and the various kinds of distortions that we've seen in the economy, for 13 years on the site, if you go to a meeting like this, and it's kind of a game of make-believe. Everyone is talking around the real issues, and the best you can really get out of it is to show up and ask some questions and hope in asking the right questions, you start to get people focused on the right subjects.
And are they focused entirely on just the economy? Are they looking at monetary, interest rate, all these policy things? Do they have any sense yet of where oil and energy might be impinging on their worldview any?
It's not on the radar, at least not in the context of this particular conference.
Okay.
The conference is really about the lingering effects of the so-called Great Recession. For example, there was one paper on the long-term effects of consumer attitudes towards the housing market. It was a very academic analysis, extremely rigorous from a data standpoint, but somehow or other they managed to miss any correlation between the fact that we have massive negative equity and in the housing market and the fact that people don't want to buy houses, and also of course unemployment, which is one of the main drivers of housing prices and turnover that drives home sales. So you have these extremely academic papers, very rigorously done, that are not really getting to the point of the problem. Now, some of the presentations were, Simon Johnson was there. He, of course, was his usual highly confrontational self.
Uh-huh.
And I asked him a couple of questions, and he was very forthright in his answers. And I did meet, Bernanke in passing. I shook his hand on the way out the door, but I didn't get to ask him any questions because, for some reason, at this particular speech, he didn't take questions, which was, I was told, quite unusual.
So let's talk about the Kaboom theory for a while, because this is really your larger framework, and you've held this framework for quite a while. Maybe you can date it for us when you first developed and got it out there, if that was right at the inception. Love to know that. But the Kaboom theory is a way of understanding the macro cycles. And if you could explain that for our listeners, I think that would be a real help, because I have a bunch of questions I want to build off of that framework as we try and peer into the future and address what might happen next.
Well, the Kaboom theory attempts to do is understand how all the debt that built up during the era of the credit bubble that began in the early 1980s and accelerated starting around 1995, how that eventually gets resolved, in an environment where politically writing down debt is not likely to happen, and that ultimately the way that debt is written down is through the exchange rate mechanisms, where markets discount the dollar, and we could have a sudden dislocation in capital flows, commonly known as a sudden stop, that would apply to the United States. This is an idea that I thought was one way of looking at how this would all turn out, and I first developed that back in 1999. Since then, I've changed it a couple times. I would describe it as phase shifting it forward, moderating it somewhat. And I think what I've learned from the last two times that we have begun a sudden stop process and it has been reversed is that we have a system which is difficult to predict in terms of its resiliency. Our trade partners are extremely committed to maintaining the system as it is. On the other hand, they've been pretty actively hedging their investment in the system by buying gold as well since about 2001.
Right. So in the Kaboom theory, we have an enormous credit run-up. Eventually, that has to give way at some point. It did in 2008 in a fairly spectacular fashion. And then you have the inevitable downward portion of that cycle where we see deflationary impacts. Certainly, we see that in housing right now. If we look at total credit market debt, there's little blips there, but it's really financial credit that's taken a big hit. We have the Fed doing everything it can, intervening. We've got trade partners helping. Still, in this Kaboom theory, are we on the downward slope of that deflationary impulse that precedes what you describe as the reflationary or massive or maybe even hyperinflationary wave that would follow?
Well, Chris, the most important thing to understand to forecast what's going to occur in our political economy is that we have effectively two economies, not one. We have one economy that I call the fire economy, which is oriented around the finance, insurance, and real estate industries, and then a second one that is oriented around productive industries. And the reason it's important to keep them separated in your mind is because from a monetary policy standpoint, they're treated quite differently. From a monetary standpoint, asset price inflation is good. Wage and commodity price inflation is bad. And so if you watch, for example, what the Fed is doing in response to deflationary forces, both in asset prices and in commodity prices, there are two different approaches, right? So so-called Operation Twist is an effort directly to drive down mortgage prices, which is really, if you think about it, a form of price fixing, right? They're trying to get create scarcity and therefore drive up mortgage prices and therefore yields down. This is a direct attempt to try to affect a change in asset prices. In this case, the collateral, which is homes, of all the outstanding mortgage debt. So they're trying to prevent asset price deflation within the FIRE economy. And at the same time, they're trying to raise inflation in the wage and commodity prices. And the way that's done is through exchange rates. That's not the explicit policy, but it's clearly the apparent policy, which has more recently been dubbed the weak dollar policy. But the idea is, if you can depreciate your currency through fiscal policy and through monetary policy, what tends to happen is that, particularly through energy prices, you can affect a change in the overall price level throughout the economy. And that's what's been done. So we effectively depreciated the dollar against oil starting in about Q2 of 2009, and that effectively halted a very brief period of deflation that we had.
So what we're talking about here is a very interventionist Fed that feels like it has the right, the capability, or maybe the obligation to then have one hand on the asset lever and one hand on the wage and commodity lever, and they are going to affect the proper outcome. Is there, in your mind, any historical precedents to suggest that such a command and control approach is a useful approach or a workable approach or has a good chance of long-term success? Where do you fall in that whole free market versus these things need to be managed spectrum?
Well, you know, back in couple answers to that. Back in 2005, when I was doing my first forecast of how I thought the housing bubble would turn out, I had two forecasts, 10 years and 15 years to revert to the mean. 10 years if there was a limited government intervention and the market was allowed to quickly correct and then come back, and much longer and more painful if it did get involved. And I thought government interference in the correction was more likely because from a political standpoint, the risks to the banking system under the current structure would have been too high. There's far too much concentration in our banking system to allow a quote-unquote natural decline. This is a so-called too-big-to-fail problem. But you have to remember that Bernanke was the guy that inherited the mess from the Greenspan Fed. And it was really under Greenspan that we had these cycles of asset price inflation that were positioned and postured as a free market phenomena, when in fact they were simply, for lack of a better term, rackets, which were designed to shift risk from fundamentally from Wall Street to the taxpayer. Now, the way that Bernanke has had to respond to this, my view is that he was hand-picked as the right guy to come in after Greenspan, because Bernanke, since he was relatively young and undergrad at Princeton, was writing papers about the Great Depression and, what went wrong and how to prevent deflation. So from my perspective, he was picked specifically for his background and his interest in doing precisely what he did do, quite predictably, in response to the deflation that resulted from all the credit inflation that preceded.
Yeah, I've always known that we were going to go down this printing road, and I knew that as soon as I read Bernanke's 2006 Jackson Hole paper, which I think was really his application essay for the job, and he very clearly laid it out, and it's of course been quoted widely and famously, where this is where he gets the helicopter moniker and all that. And I'm just the kind of person that says, look, if somebody says they're going to do something and then they actually do it, there's no real mystery as to what just happened there. I know people are still on the side of the view of saying that deflation is still the more powerful force. It's going to overwhelm the ability of the Fed to respond. Bernanke can have his magic printing press all he wants, but the forces here are just too large. They're too structural. They're too embedded. Perhaps something like we see going on in Europe is just too big for the system. So you call it a political economy, thinking of the Fed maybe as part of that, or if you want to parse that out further, feel free. But how do you fall on that spectrum? Do you believe deflation, the markets, et cetera, are larger than the Fed at all, or do they have a number of tricks up their sleeve yet? In fact, can they continue this game for a lot longer?
Well, Chris, I've been hearing this argument from the deflationists since 1998 when I first started ICUA. Remember, the first time was we had this big stock market bubble, and I was debating various economics analysts on the likely outcome of that, and many of them thought that when the bubble finally collapsed, we'd have a deflationary depression like we had in the 1930s. The stock market bubble would crash like the stock market of 1929 and so forth. And I tried to explain to them that we're not being on the gold standard, that there was nothing limiting the ability of the Fed to expand its balance sheet to do two things. One, to provide liquidity, and also simply to take bad assets out of the market and put it on its own. Since most people didn't understand that's how the Fed operates now and that the situations are different, I understand why they would be confused. And, you know, then what I heard back in 2006 when I reopened ITULIP was the same argument all over again, except this time, you know, Eric, it's going to involve the whole banking system, the entire structure of credit. There's just too many trillions of dollars. The Fed can't possibly back it up. And I said, well, when you look at the Fed's balance sheet a couple of years from now, you're going to see trillions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities and all sorts of other stuff on it, and because, you know, that's what they said they're going to do. So the answer is, it's a little bit like arguing with somebody over and over again about whether the world is round or flat, and you go around the world a couple of times, and they still don't understand what that means. It means that the world's not flat.
Right. You know, I don't know what the limit is to the Fed balance sheet. I was, you know, if you 5 years ago sat me down and said, you know, we're going to have the Fed balance sheet at $2.8 trillion, I said, what? No way. But here we are. And so could it go to 5 or 7 or 10? I can't think of a reason, technical reason why it can't. Maybe a political reason, maybe a geopolitical reason. So as I look at what the Fed is really up to here, though, if maybe you can clear up one mystery for me. So Bloomberg does this big FOIA thing and, you know, pries out of the Fed the fact that they had either directly or through guarantees backstopped an ungodly amount, trillions and trillions of dollars in both domestic and foreign firms, both official and private. And my question to you is, do you have any insight into why it is a lot of those guarantees never showed up in any of the statements I read? They didn't show up on the Fed balance sheet in any way. Are those extra off-balance sheet things? Do they not count guarantees in sort of an accounting standard? Do you have any idea as to what we're looking at on the Fed balance sheet is truly a good measure of what they are on the hook for or have in any way guaranteed?
Well, this is one of the other challenges in talking to economists about our modern economy, because we have a finance-based economy, and most universities have the economics department, and then the finance is taught over in the business school. And so most economists don't really understand enough about finance to understand how our economy really works. So when they are confronted with this question of, you know, deflation and who's holding the bag, mm-hmm. if you actually take a careful look at the Fed's balance sheet, the Fed, unlike any other kind of bank, can do magical things. For example, it can take what is a liability for a commercial bank and put it on its balance sheet simultaneously as an asset and a liability that cancels out to zero. So, for example, it will take a few hundred billion dollars in asset-backed securities, put it in the maiden lien fund or whatever one of those funds is called, as an asset, and simultaneously on the ledger as a actually as a deposit. It's technically how it's listed. And if you before the crisis, the net holdings of the Federal Reserve was something like $35 billion. And after they took on a couple trillion dollars of bad assets, it's still $35 billion. So it's might strike some people as kind of magical, but, you know, in theory, as Greenspan said many years ago, the Fed can, in theory, expand its balance sheet infinitely. It's the unique characteristic of the way a central bank operates that's different from a commercial bank.
Ah, that really clears up a mystery for me. So unless we had access, some sort of audit access or records access, we don't really know. I think the Bloomberg data when I started pouring through it really opened up my eyes to exactly that dynamic that you just explained. So thank you for clearing that up. Okay, so here we have the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, also Bank of England. Let's not forget the Swiss National Bank. So, and probably some others I've forgotten to list, all basically printing at this point in various ways, or we can call it providing liquidity. But let's be fair. There is money being created out of thin air in many cases here, to manage all kinds of things, exchange rate, risk, and dynamics, you know, to buy up bad assets, to push liquidity back into the system, to recapitalize banks, whatever. So all the way back from the time I first was aware of your work, you'd been a pretty big proponent of gold. And I think you were there right at the secular market lows, the beginning of the previous decade. Do you talk to us about the connection, you know, you see between monetary policy now and gold, if any, for you? And as well, you also talked about rising gold prices is probably going to have several distinct phases. Which phase are we in now?
So, Chris, my thesis in, you know, waiting 20 years, I started watching gold back in the mid-1980s and was very much a stock market bull for most of my career in the high technology industry from the late 1980s until the early 2000s. And so it wasn't until 2001 that I finally made a decision to take a 15% position in gold. It was at the same time that we had sold our stock from our equity positions in technology companies and bought treasury bonds in late 2000. And that wound up being the portfolio. It was gold and treasury bonds, and it has been ever since. Mm-hmm. The theory behind it is that the system, a global monetary system that was very U.S.-centric, was really designed back in a time when the United States was about 54-58% of the global economy. As of now, it's about 18%. So we have this U.S.-centric monetary system attached to a much more broadly-based economy. So here we have this mismatch between the monetary system and the actual structure of the economy. And here we also have the United States behaving with these asset bubbles in a way that is not consistent with the country that is the issuer of the world's reserve currency. That to qualify for that position, you have to really stand well above other countries in the world in terms of transparency and other factors that prove the legitimacy of that position. And I saw that beginning to erode back during the period of the stock market bubble, and then accelerate, of course, during the housing bubble. And what I thought was going to happen is that there is no plan B in the global monetary system. When we switched over to the U.S. dollar reserve basis for global monetary reserves, the only fallback is gold. Gold is the only reserve asset that central banks hold other than dollars and to some extent euros, but it's mostly gold. So gold is the fallback. So what I thought was going to happen is that over time and gradually that there would be an increase at some point in gold holdings by central banks as they hedged the marginal increase in the number of treasury bonds that they needed to hold as a result of conducting trade with the U.S. and also simply maintaining the U.S. economy through low interest rates and providing sufficient investment to continue to operate the U.S. Government. So it's very interesting to me that starting in second quarter of 2009, right after the financial crisis, is when global central banks became net buyers of gold, which to me indicated that they had, as a group, determined that it was time to more seriously hedge their dollar assets. Even as they continued to buy treasury bonds, they needed to increase their hedging. Before that, there were effectively two teams. There were the buyers who were countries like India and Russia and China, and the sellers, which are mostly European countries. And that structure of the gold market occurred, it was maintained until the second quarter of 2009, and it shifted to a much broader base increase in the number of governments participating in the gold market, including Saudi Arabia, Mexico, and other allies of the United States.
Right. So we have the United States here operating the reserve currency, doing it poorly at some point, because another piece I'd like to toss in here is the current account deficit driven by the trade deficit primarily, which really started to the downside in the early 1990s, right around 1990-91, and then just never looked back. And with that, I also combine the fiscal deficit, which together, current account plus a fiscal deficit, is a pretty whopping funding bill that needs to be supported. And it's half supported at this point by foreign official buyers, foreign central banks. And as we look into that, we see this thing called the custody account at the Fed, which is one main repository for some of those reserve treasury holdings, and also agency debt. And it's just a whopper. I mean, it's Eric, when I look at that account, what I see is it's not driven by the response to the crisis in 2008. In fact, you can start in 2002, put a ruler under that current account, and just draw a line, about a 45-degree line up. It's about a little over 15% annual compounded accumulation in that. What was driving that? And it's again, it's not, in my mind, linked to the crisis we're in, because you can't see any wiggle in the trajectory at 2008 or 9 or 7. I mean, there's no bump in it. It's just a ruler strut from 2002. Are you saying that that was primarily driven by this, let's call it international global vendor financing? Is that the main dynamic behind that, or is there something else here?
Well, Chris, I think there's a number of theories to explain, the two things, the growth rate and the consistency of it. If you look at net capital inflows to the U.S., they grow when the U.S. economy is growing, and the composition of that changes over time between official and private investors. But what's really important is that the growth rate overall be generally maintained in order to ensure markets that there are sufficient inflows to fund the U.S. Economic activity. It's probably not particularly well known, but back in 2003, when we had our earlier crisis, there was a point where 70% of the U.S. government operations was being funded by foreign purchases of U.S. debt. So the way the country operates is, there are certain times when we're counting largely on domestic purchases, other times on foreign purchases, but fundamentally we're kind of all in it together. This is the way the system works. The Chinese aren't all that happy about having all the U.S. Treasury bonds they have, but they know perfectly well what would happen if there were not buyers. On the other hand, they are behaving as if, okay, well, we'll buy them because we know we have to maintain the system, but we're going to buy more gold to hedge the risk that that investment in U.S. Treasury bonds represents.
All right, so I wanted to cover that territory just a little bit, because if there's two places that a foreign official buyer, central bank, is going to stash their money, one is in treasuries and other obligations like that to maintain the system, preserve the status quo. The other being the gold holdings. And so you saw that secular shift away from being net dishoarders of gold into net accumulators of gold. It's a fairly recent shift, historically speaking, to become accumulators again. Does that change where you think we are in terms of the phase of gold prices at this point? Do you see a sharper trajectory now as the world monetary system experiences the slings and arrows of fortune here as certain difficulties? Or do you think we're still in a phase of steady rising prices, if even that?
Well, that's an interesting question. Indeed, it has gone through a number of phases. When I first got into it in 2001, gold was widely derided as a terrible investment. It had been going down in price for over 20 years. If you open the Wall Street Journal, you'd have to dig around to find any price, never mind a mention of it. So, and it didn't really become a topic of news until quite a few years later. But the fact is, it's been going up in price every single year, year after year, for 10 years. And in fact, the rise has been so consistent that it has, with respect to almost anything else, particularly stocks, been much more less volatile and more consistent in its rise. So this is, to me, indicative of this overall trend, which is, I would describe it as the dissolution of the U.S. Treasury dollar-based monetary system. And that process of dissolution is going through various stages, the most recent one being global central banks becoming net buyers. And you probably saw a recent jump in prices the last couple of days. You can be pretty sure that what's going on in Europe right now is driving some additional sales. I think it's important to understand also that what you can read about who is buying and who has what by looking at the Bank for International Settlements reports is somewhat limited. I am aware of individuals, that is families, who are buying very large quantities of gold in the order of tens of tons that are not going reported there.
Yeah, well, it doesn't take very many families accumulating tens of tons to distort a market that's actually fairly tight when you you look at the total gold market. I know a lot of dollar value of it flips every day, but in terms of the physical market, I've seen some work by Eric Sprout that really details what the physical market actually does, and it's a lot tighter than maybe many sort of suspect. The paper markets give us some churn and the appearance of liquidity, but it's not a very big market. Let's put it that way, compared to the dollar flows that are available to siphon and funnel into one market or the other. Okay, so I want to ask, so let's talk about for a second, does peak oil, I know peak oil factors into your macro view a little bit, but if you could just tell us how peak oil, maybe peak other natural resources, how do these play in? You know, we've got Jeremy Grantham recently, I think, really going off the reservation in terms of his investing style to really put his mark down and say, look, there's a big looming story here. He calls it a paradigm shift. I'm certainly in that camp of thinking that anybody who's got an endowment or a pension time frame to their thinking certainly has to be considering this story. And I argue everybody should because we're there. That's my view. What are your views on this, and how do you weave this into your macro view?
Well, I met Jeremy Grantham, and he's obviously a very wise, experienced veteran of the industry and has made some very good calls, particularly around the time that, you know, I was talking about the technology bubble. He was as well, and quite clearly and rigorously. He has also started to build what I call peak cheap oil into his models. It's a term that we adopted back in 2007 to try to distinguish between the overall idea, you know, the physical fact of a reduction in the total amount of oil endowment and its impact on prices and on the macroeconomy. So the fact is that there is a lot of oil out there still. And when I was writing my book, Post-Catastrophe Economy, and I was interviewing people like Joe Petrosky, who's the CEO of Gulf Oil, and others, to try to understand the industry's perspective on this process, it, you know, became, you know, pretty clear that we've gone in a relatively short period of time, really the last 40 or 50 years, from oil that was relatively inexpensively extracted with relatively primitive technology to oil that is increasingly more expensive to extract and produce with extremely sophisticated technology. So I think to understand how wildly sophisticated technology is these days for oil production, you know, you have to look at what's actually done. The big shift that improved oil production over the last, particularly over the last 10 years, has been in computers. So we had a lot of data about where the oil was, but not a lot of computing power to crunch the data to determine exactly where the most likely sources are that can be economically extracted. And it used to take a bunch of Cray computers, and now it just takes a couple of workstations. So the good news is we know where the oil is. The bad news is we know where the oil is, meaning that there is very unlikely to be any large quantities that haven't already been located and the economics of their extraction been determined.
And not just the dollar economics, but the energy economics as well. I mean, clearly we're pouring a lot more energy in to get slightly less back out and increasingly less. And of course, we run our economy on the net of those activities, whatever the price may be. It's certainly a view that I think anybody who's been solely focused in just the economic sphere really needs to start paying attention to. It's one of my chief complaints, such as they are, around how the Fed operates. I'm not aware that they have anybody with such a view anywhere in their stable of advisors, let alone voting members. So,
I'm not, Chris. Let me interject. I'm not entirely sure that's true. I think that at the moment they have bigger fish to fry. In their view, it's a longer term issue. But I do happen to know that they are thinking about, you know, how central bank policy can operate in an environment of persistently rising energy prices, because that implies a long-term trend toward increased cost push inflation. And, you know, if how do you manage monetary policy when input prices to production are continuously rising, which is acting as a tax on consumers, and at the same time, producers are unable to pass on those costs, and so generally speaking, it's going to be slowing the economy. So I think it presents challenges that they're thinking about, but within the framework of, you know, the way our current global central banking system works, there really isn't an answer.
Right. So it is a very narrow way, if they're addressing it, looking at the cost push components and trying to understand the monetary aspects of that and other pieces. But if you take this other view and we step in from the side and say it's actually about the net energy, it's energy return on energy invested, and we have this central banking superstructure that requires this expansion for whatever reason, because of how it's set up, debt-based money. Hey, we need exponential expansion of money and debt. We have a conflict there. And so I'm always intrigued when I see who's really paying attention to this, and I see militaries around the world paying attention to this, so they're yeah. doing it. I work with corporations that absolutely have their eye on the ball and are aware of it. No, don't know what to do with it yet, but certainly are starting to chew on it. So let me differentiate and say I don't know that our government is unaware of it. I would say the institutional career branch, there are people in there who get it. It's the elected portion that I'm not quite as clear about at this point in time, and that goes for the Fed as well at this stage. So that's a little.
I think the explanation for that is just the career timeframes.
Yeah.
From the standpoint of politicians, it's something that's going to happen, later. It's not like the foreclosure crisis, which, is an immediate election impacting issue. Today it looks like oil prices are as much driven by dollar value as by demand and supply. So there's room for some debate, and if there's room for debate, then there's ways to avoid it.
Yeah, I agree. There's all sorts of reasons to understand the lack of response, and the political angle's an important one here. You've been increasingly vocal. I've noticed that our leaders really wasted the wake-up call in 2008. Are there any steps in your mind that we really could take at this point to get the ship back on the right course?
Well, Chris, the biggest my warning in my book was that we had a relatively short period of time to get back on the right track, starting in second, third quarter of 2009. We needed to take fairly precipitous action to get a annual growth rate up to about 4% GDP a year in order to get out of the output gap that was created by the recession. We've managed just north of 2%, so at this rate we'll simply never get out of it. And what that means is that the long-term unemployment problem that we have will just get longer and bigger over time. That has political repercussions, as we can see from the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the knock-on effects of that over time are very counterproductive and unconstructive policy decisions that simply, we will pile one bad decision on top of another.
So if you're a concerned individual or corporation, you're looking at this framework right now, what steps can individuals, corporations take at this point to insulate themselves from these trends that we've just been talking about?
Well, it depends on the industry. I talk to everything from insurance companies to commercial real estate firms to a lot of technology companies, of course, because that's the industry that I come out of. It really depends on the industry. For if you're in the energy industry, of course, it's a boon. I was writing articles back in 2008 when people were asking me what should I go into to avoid this crash you see coming. And I said, move to Idaho, move to Texas, Oklahoma, places where there's going to be a lot of jobs still, because despite the recession, energy prices are going to remain high. Aside from the energy sector and also the agricultural sector, which are clearly areas that are going to continue to improve in spite of the impact of peak cheap oil and of debt deflation, there are some industries which I think are going to continue to suffer for the foreseeable future, including residential real estate. I don't see any end in sight for a decline in that industry. There was, and I'll give you a specific, there, one of the presentations at the Federal Reserve last week was by a very thoughtful economist who had a really good plan, I thought, for reprivatizing Fannie and Freddie, getting them from being nationalized banks to fully private banks over through basically a four-step process, which might take, you know, 5 to 10 years, something like that. And it all seemed very reasonable, except for one small problem. It implies that you would, the mortgages in the secondary market would eventually have to reflect actual default risk, which today would probably put a mortgage around 9 or 10% in the secondary market. And I have, you know, friends out on the West Coast that are writing hard money mortgages at about 9%. So the question is, how politically, you know, is Congress going to be able to push through this plan to reprivatize Fannie and Freddie as mortgage rates go from 3 to 6 to 8 to 10% or whatever they do, and the housing market goes down and down and down? And are the real estate lobbies going to sit around and just watch this happen? And the answer I got was no, they probably won't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a perfect framework for the problem that we have today, which is we have a bunch of special interests, which largely produce a lot of the problems we have, who are not getting out of the way to allow us to implement policies that are going to address these problems.
And for the concerned individual who has a portfolio, are you still advising, is gold a portion of that? Its treasury still makes sense? Do you have advice there, or is that the kind of thing you provide?
Well, we're long gold since 2001 for the duration, meaning until the end of the current monetary regime. I don't see how this particular regime will last forever, but you never know how much longer it can be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout that process, I see gold prices going up. Back in 2001, my best estimate was somewhere between 2,500 and 5,000, which sounded kind of crazy back when it was at 270.
Yep.
A little
yep.
less crazy today. But in terms of Treasury bonds, that's a lot more tricky. That's one of those situations where you would expect Treasury bonds should decline in price and yields should rise. But Treasury bonds don't behave in a should fashion when they're issued by the reserve asset that's used by the world, and where everyone is dependent on the stability of that system. So we always strongly advise anybody against shorting them. That's extremely dangerous. And also, we are continuing to hold our treasury bond positions, but are gradually diversifying into other things,
mm-hmm.
Such as funds that take advantage of rising rents and energy prices.
Excellent. Okay. Great advice. We're going to have to wrap here. We've been talking with Eric Jansen, founder and president of iTulip Inc., and of course, operator of iTulip.com. Great website. You should go check it out if you haven't. Lots of excellent advice there, as well as a subscription service. Well worth the money. And author as well of The Post-Catastrophe Economy. I hope that does well. Eric, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Have a good day.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.